Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Welcome, everyone, once again to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. Steve Fielder here coming at you from the road, that long and winding road from Florida all the way up to New Jersey. Can you imagine a redneck hillbilly like me in New Jersey, about 60 miles from New York City? Corey Groover, my compatriot in crime, is not here in Jersey, but he's one state over. How you doing tonight, Corey?
I'm doing pretty good, Steve. I think you're probably still about as far away from me as you would be in Florida.
Yeah, Pennsylvania is a wide state, isn't it? I mean, from east to west, it's a long, long ways across there.
Yeah, you're not kidding about that.
Well, somebody said one time, the more that our country, our culture gets away from the family farm, the less common sense less common sense is prevalent. Right here in this area of New Jersey where I am is in the western part, and there's actually some hills, some ridges. There's a trout stream right near here that I always try to fish when I'm up here, but so far I haven't been able to do it because it always rains. And trout fishing or fly fishing especially is not good when the creeks are out of their banks and it's all muddy and all, you know. So without making this a fly fishing podcast, I won't talk about that, but there are some ways you can fish the higher water and all, but it's just not fun. And for an old guy like me, I got to watch where I'm wading. I may be floating and bobbing instead of wading. But anyway, we came up 2 days. This is the third day I've been away from home. And, of course, my CEO of the Fielder household is with me. Ella's with me. We're here house-sitting, and this is a subject maybe we can talk about a little bit. We're house-sitting Susan's dog, Rocket.
Rocket?
Rocket Man. Rocket is a rescue out of the state of South Carolina that is described by the rescue agency to be hound and pit bull. He does have the body of a hound. He's predominantly white. He's got kind of a tannish, almost that yellowish headset. You know, in the Walker breed, and of course I think he would probably tend to be maybe a foxhound pit cross, but there's the red-headed dogs is what I prefer in a Walker dog. Then there's a kind of the brownish head, and there's the light tan. It comes to mind dogs like Lonnie Mears dogs out there in Missouri and all. And then you get this one that's kind of a cream, but it's almost borderline going into a brownish color. And I've seen this some on some of the wipeout dogs that have the black pigment on their faces and around their lips and so forth. And I don't know where that comes from, but the point here is old Rocket is one of the most athletic dogs that I have ever seen. I mean, he has springs on all four legs. And I mean, he can move around the room like a mosquito. and part of my commitment to come up and for us to come up and house sit and dog sit while Susan takes a much needed vacation with some of her friends down to Mexico. I think she flew into Cancun Airport today. Maybe, I'm not sure. But anyway, is to kind of, you know, take a little of that energy down.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Steve. What does a New Jerseyan do with a dog like that to keep it
what, in good shape? Okay, you have a daughter, right?
Well, yeah.
And you're going to have another one here pretty soon, and that's going to be a girl too, right?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Nothing like them.
I'm adding.
Do you imagine? go ahead. I'm sorry.
I said I'm adding an addition onto the dog kennel right now.
Yeah, for all the puppies you got. No, but can you imagine those two daughters doing everything that you want them to do, or completely follow your logic about everything?
Oh, absolutely.
Not at this time. I don't know. You know, it's that old, when I was in sales, it was like we had what we called the puppy dog clothes. The guy's selling color TVs on the floor, you know. So, well, back in the day, now I'm dating myself. Guy can't make a decision whether to buy it or not. The salesman said, well, just take it home with you and, you know, watch it tonight. And if you don't like it, you don't think it's a good buy, then call us and we'll come back and pick it up.
Oh, there you go.
Well, yeah. But, of course, when all the kids saw the TV that night, no, do you think that guy's going to get to send that back? Same thing with the new car. Just drive it home and keep it overnight. And if you don't like it, bring it back tomorrow. Well, he's parked it in the driveway. And all the neighbors see that he's got a new car there. You think he's going to take that back?
Heck no, man.
Well, anyway, these rescues, you know, this was a cute puppy, and he was cute, and he's still a good-looking dog, and he's very smart, but he has way too much energy. But now here's my point. Maybe some of our listeners can tune in on this a little bit. As my pastor at church says, now you got to lean in on what I'm about to say here.
Okay, I'm leaning.
All right. In the experience of hog hunters, predominantly in the South, where most people hunt hogs with dogs, are there any dogs out there that are successfully crossed between pit bulls and hounds? I had a friend in Florida back in my college days that used to, he was a plot guy. He said he would occasionally raise a litter of halves. That's what he called them, half pit, half plot. But he said they usually didn't last through the season. It wasn't because he was culling them. It was because the game was culling them. Right. You know, hog is probably about the roughest game that you can hunt with a dog. My father would not run his bear dogs on hogs. Some plot guys do. But it's a different deal. But I just wonder.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I just wonder if there's anyone out there under this wide umbrella of Gone to the Dogs podcast that has successfully crossed hound with pit and used them for, well, use them for anything. I was talking to somebody just this, I believe it was Teddy Morgan from West Virginia, that has a pit bull female that's a tremendous squirrel dog.
No kidding.
And has been all her life. And a real tree dog, he says. And she's full pit bull terrier.
Well, now, you know, I think that's interesting because a lot of the literature that you can get your hands on, I'm talking from back in the 1920s to 1930s, you know, a lot of times when they address breeding practices or different crosses that are successful, you'll find the term bull blood in there. And bull blood is referring to those crosses that are made you know, between what we would probably consider a pit bull and a coonhound. And I don't think they're talked about extremely favorably, but they did exist, and those crosses were made pretty frequently by the sound of it.
Right. Well, we know the history of these dogs, and you know, the breed was Bulldog, and the UKC, one of their earliest breeds that they recognized was the American Pit Bull Terrier. The American Kennel Club chose to call them American Staffordshire Terriers, and they're the same breed. They're the same dogs. They've been bred different lines down through the years and so forth. But, and, you know, there was a time in this country where dog fighting was legal. In fact, if you go back in the archives that we've talked about in the United Kennel Club back in the very earliest days, there were results and ads and so forth on pit bull dogs and their success in the ring and so forth. Well, you know, times have changed. And one of the arguments that we successfully used in these ordinances around the country where these well-meaning but undereducated people want to ban that breed, we would say, you know, of course, if the dogs were bred for that originally, they aren't anymore. And can you imagine a dog that was vicious toward men and women being used in an arena, in a public exhibition bout or whatever you want to call it? I mean, no, they were always, you know, trainable, biddable. You know, great dogs and family dogs. And I've mentioned before when we, you know, when I did my exploratory journeys down in the basement at UKC through the old records and found the actual registration document of Petey, which was the dog on the Little Rascals popular TV show, you know, or movies. They were actually movies. But anyway, so we got really deep in those pit bull weeds here, Corey. But I would be interested to know if anybody's using hound and pit crosses, what are you using them for? Do they tree? I know as far as being athletic, this dog right here is phenomenal. And he's a real sweetheart. I mean, he's a lover. He'll pile right up on the couch with you and wants his head in your lap and very sweet. But if there's a game to play or something, and we have to be careful because we bring our dachshund along, and we have to kind of, when they first get together, they want a roughhouse. And that doesn't bode well for little Louie because of that, you know, they're prone to back injuries. So, you know, a couple good stomps by Rocket and Louie would probably be out of commission. But anyway, he is. I can't stress enough how gentle and I mean, loving he is. He's just rambunctious. So we're working on that already. He's sitting back about 10 feet from the door because he liked to kind of escape when the door was open. You know, he would dart by our daughter and be out exploring the neighborhood, you know, which, but anyway, let us know, folks. Post it on Coon Hunting Conversations if you like. And we're going to talk about Coon Hunting Conversations in a minute, Corey, but I thought we might jump into this thing about the big event that's coming up just a week from tomorrow night as we are recording this. I think, what are we on, April 3rd?
Yeah, April 3rd.
Okay, so on April the 11th, which will be a week from tomorrow night, will be the first night of competition for the Tournament of Champions.
Yeah, isn't that exciting?
Man, that is. You know, AKC, man, I got too many KCs on my resume. UKC really hit a grand slam with that event, I think. Didn't have it back in my day. I didn't think of it. You know, we did things a little different. I will say that we began the idea of awarding championships on Cass wins when I went to AKC. And UKC did pick that concept up in this TOC, and where a dog has to get 5 wins throughout the calendar year, I believe, right?
Yep.
So, and this year, I think if you listen to last week's podcast with Mark Miller, he talked about the fact that he had 2 dogs with 4 wins and 1 with a single win. So he didn't actually get anything qualified for this year. You get the 5 wins. Not only does that qualify you for Tournament of Champions, it also makes your dog a night champion. Correct. So that's kind of a double-edged award there. And as we're talking, the zone, do they call them zones or regionals?
In the regions.
Regions. Okay. Were held just this past weekend. I don't have the list of the locations. I know some of them.
But I have that.
You got that?
I sure do.
Well, lay it on me, brother.
Region 1 was Kirksville, Missouri.
Yeah.
Region 2 was LaGrange, Indiana. Some fantastic.
Okay, let me do this little game. We're going to play a little game. You said Kirksville, Missouri.
Kirksville, Missouri.
Okay. There was a guy, a black and tan guy from Kirksville, Missouri. Do you know who he was? I bet some of my listeners do.
Oh, I know black and tan history so well.
No, it wasn't Hans Wagner.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure about that, to be honest with you.
A great guy, hardworking guy. Garnett Gordon.
Oh, was I never would have gotten
Kirksville, Missouri. Okay. Now you mentioned LaGrange, Indiana. Who does that remind you of?
I think you just like making me feel bad because I don't know.
Hey, I'm trying to show you up here, buddy. No, that young mind of yours, I'll trade you any day.
Yeah.
I'll trade you any day. I always think, when I think of LaGrange, Indiana, I think of the guy in the cowboy hat, the Blue Dog Man.
Oh, Dave Dean.
No, but that's close. Yeah. Dave Dean didn't wear a cowboy hat. I guess if a cowboy's wearing it, it's a cowboy hat. But yeah, Dave wore what I would call kind of a mountain hat. It looked like... Okay. You know, like some of my old relatives, the Hatfields, might have worn. No, the guy that LaGrange, Indiana reminds me of is Steve Burkholder.
Oh, Steve.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of a historical reference.
Well, Steve's getting pretty old, you know.
Well, that's true.
I haven't seen that rascal since he moved to Florida. He's down spending most of his time on the golf course, I think.
Oh, I bet you.
Yeah, I always enjoyed Steve. Of course, he's been doing the color work, the play-by-play and on whatever on the Tournament of Champions the last couple of years. And, you know, I was privileged to be able to do that the first year. And that was something we can talk about in a little bit, too. Okay, what other locations we got?
Okay, Region 3, we have Mount Gilead, Ohio.
Oh, wow. I can think of a lot of things there. But does anything come to mind when you say Mount Gilead, Ohio?
Okay, so I might butcher this, but if I'm not mistaken, the only plot hound ever won the UKC World Hunt won it out of Mount Gilead, Ohio.
That's correct.
Oh, all right.
For extra points, extra credit, do you remember what year it was?
Ooh. I'm going to guess, but I'm not going to guarantee it's right. I'm going to say 1988.
Man, go to the head of the class.
Oh.
You nailed that one, too. All right. I guess it'd be pushing my luck if I asked you to name the owners of that dog.
Oh, yeah, you'd be pushing it. I know the dog's name is Kansas Sizzling Heat.
That is exactly right, and you do get extra credit for that, too.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Jim Cannon and Spud Reynolds were the guys that blew out of that zone hunt down in Paris, Texas, and came up to Ohio. I know Russ Downing was in that final cast with a blue dog.
Yes, sir. Would that have been Tree and Blue Toad?
It would.
Yeah, Tree and Blue Toad.
And I can't remember the other two right off the top of my head, so I go back on the back row.
Yeah.
I go back on the Baptist row back there.
The only reason I know that is because I know Russ well myself. I consider him a good friend, but the very first coon dog I ever owned in my life was a blue tick coon hound, and she was a great ancestor to Tree and Blue Toad. So.
I see. Was she all blue?
No, she wasn't. She was a grand pup to Spare Time Spanky.
Yeah.
And she had all her tan markings, so.
Oh, yeah, there was another great one. Well, when we do blue ticks, we'll dig into some of those great dogs like that. But Russ Downing certainly was a force in competition hunting. And of course, Absolutely. You mentioned Dave Dean earlier. And there's so many, but we can get into that later. And okay, what was the next location?
We got Region 4 out of 10 Mile, Tennessee.
10 Mile, Tennessee, one name and one name only pops into my mind from 10 Mile. Who do you think of?
Nobody in particular.
A former field rep for United Kennel Club.
Okay.
A guy that builds and sells hunting lights.
Okay.
His name is Glenn Allen Roberts.
Glenn Allen Roberts.
You know Allen Roberts?
No, I don't know that I met him.
You don't know Allen. He was one of the reps back in my day. But that's who I think about when I think of 10 Mile, Tennessee.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, what else we got?
Next off, we got Region 5 out of Conway, Arkansas.
Conway, Arkansas. I've got the name, and it's buzzing around up there, and it's not coming to me yet. When I went out to the Blue Tick Breeders and Coon Hunters Association's fall roundups, they typically had them in places like I don't know that they actually had it in Conway. They had it at Hope and Pine Bluff and places like that. But this guy's name is right there on the tip of my tongue, but it won't come to me.
I'm not familiar with Arkansas that much, but would Conway be anywhere near some of the satellite clubs that they use for Winter Classic or no?
No, that would be a little out of the range of the Winter Classic, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
About the only club I think that they use in Arkansas is over at Marianna, and we've mentioned Philip Heron before. And Phillips Club over there, they always take casts for Winter Classic. But that's in North eastern central Arkansas. But not all that far from Memphis, Tennessee. All right, what else we got? Is that it?
We got the last region is Region 6 out of Manning, South Carolina.
Manning, South Carolina. I pass by that exit all the time, going and coming from Florida. I can't think of anybody particular except about a million hunters that always hunt the Grand American each year. I think of I think of Tim Kramer down at Ridgeland, Indiana. I think of Ed Ottman. Do you know what Ed Ottman's nickname is?
Ooh, gosh. You're just making me look like a simpleton today.
No, I wouldn't expect you. His nickname is Pig Eye.
Pig Eye.
Pig Eye. Yep. If anybody, you talk about Ed Ottman down in South Carolina, they'll say, "Who? Ottman's he in relation to Pig Eye?"
Yeah.
great guy and a real competition hunter. Back in his.
Let's just put it this way. I do not want to know how he got that.
Well, if you ever meet Ed, you'll enjoy the experience, I guarantee.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's probably enough of my trivia foolishness, but I like to play games with places I've been and things I've seen. And
sure. And, well, it might be worth mentioning, too, the finals are going to be held here over April 13th weekend. So that's going to be April 11th through the 13th. And it's going to be held in Greencastle, Indiana.
Yeah, Greencastle. What a great venue for a coon hunt. And of course, Autumn Oaks was there for 20 years. So many memories that guys my age would have of the hunts at Greencastle, you know, over those years. And for UKC to pick Greencastle as their venue for the Tournament of Champions to me was a great choice. And I guess Doug Cundiff was a field rep when you were with UKC, was he not?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and see, Doug's dad, Charlie, was a field rep when I was there. And, of course, Doug was the kid coming up, you know. But that's a great group around there at Greencastle.
I've actually been fortunate enough to – well, I mean, I've hunted out of LaGrange, Indiana, where Region 2 is. But I've hunted down in Greencastle. I specifically drove down there, and I hunted with Doug and Charlie and Cody Carter. A couple of different times, and I'll tell you what, for it's hilly, but there's some good coon hunting there, I can tell you that much.
Oh yeah, definitely. So if you get just a little west of Greencastle over there around Putmanville in there, you're going to get into the hills and those little valleys, you know, little steep little creek banks and stuff, you know. I remember one night judging a cast out of Sullivan, Indiana, with PKC during Super Stakes time and going up there, and it was a rainy night. It rained really hard. We met the cast there at the truck stop just off of I-70 at Cloverdale, and man, those raindrops felt like lead weights when they smacked you in the eyeball trying to shine a tree, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, Greencastle, Indiana, at least from my perspective, has really turned into a central hub for competitive coon hunting over the past decade. I mean, you got guys like Tyler Pettit down there. You got Jared and Keith Hutchinson. I mean, all kinds of major competition hunters coming out of that particular town and that particular club.
Yeah.
And these are the same guys you're going to see that are, you know, often judging at major UKC events and PKC events alike. And, you know, that's a pretty prominent PKC club too.
Yeah. Well, that area has raised up, as you say, a lot of good coon hunters over the years. Guys that hunted around that area, Tom Hacker in the English breed, Ron Taylor, the blue tick man, who was very prominent in the older days of Purina. Tim Whitaker with his black and tans, also a big Purina guy. We mentioned Charlie and Doug Cundiff and just so many around there. And, you know, the guy that was kind of my predecessor, a few years before that managed Ottomoke so many years, Manfred Craver, lived in Greencastle. And if you go back in the old American Cooners, you'll see the original rules corner columns, which I look forward to reading every month in American Cooner. Manfred lived there in Greencastle. And I guess that was helped, you know, with the hunt being there at the Putnam County Fairgrounds. Just a great, great area. Well, on this TOC, I was looking on this magic device that I have here that has a screen and such. And if I can find again now, I think I just lost. No, it'll come back to me. I wanted to mention the breakdown here on the Tournament of Champions. Now, we mentioned those regions, and they advanced, I believe, 96 dogs out of the regions to the finals this coming weekend. Now, actually, I say this coming weekend, as we are airing this podcast, the Tournament of Champions will be taking place the following weekend, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's break it down here, Corey. As usual, the walkers are kind of dominating the field in these. How many walkers you got? Do you have it in front of you?
I don't.
Okay, I got it right here. I was going to give you a chance to really really shine.
Really dazzle the crowd. Huh?
That's right. You know what they say, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you baffle them with BS. No, but there's out of 96 dogs now, guys, think about it. And who could argue with the success of this breed in competition coon hunting? 77 treeing walkers out of 96. That only leaves 19 more.
Yeah. Right.
How many, what do you think the ratio of males to females would be?
I mean, ideally, I would probably say pretty darn close to 50-50.
Uh-huh. Well.
But I was never good at math. So.
Yeah, well, I went about a mile to school, so I'm fairly good at math. Of course, it was uphill both ways, snow covered, you know, back in West Virginia when I went to school. But anyway,
yeah.
No.
Everybody's.
Right. No, actually, the males almost a 2-to-1 ratio, and that breaks down to the overall entry. I'll just say this, put this right out there. They're out of the 96 dogs, there's 60 males and 36 females.
Oh,
so
God.
It's about 60% to 40%, you know. But anyway, treeing walkers had 49 and 28. Which breed do you think might be second?
Ooh, I'm gonna say it's a toss up between English coon hounds, and that's tough. It could go either way between black and tans and blue ticks, but I'm gonna go black and tan.
No, if you had said the next two breeds are English and blue tick, you would have been correct. The English dogs have 8 entries, and interestingly, the only breed where the females outnumber the males.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's 5 females and 3 males out of the 8 dogs. You know, the English breed has always been pretty much second place in the registry behind the walkers. Very mm-hmm. popular breed. And, you know, my favorites with the English, I hunted in North Carolina when I was with AKC. I hunted with a fellow that liked the English dogs, Monk Perry. And he had some nice dogs. Monk was a guy to go out and buy a good dog. And he had some real nice ones. But his dogs were predominantly red tick. And, of course, I lived in Michigan, very close to a guy that won the World Hunt with an English dog, Larry Wilcox. And hunted with Larry many nights over the years. We didn't routinely hunt together, but we did take several hunts over the years I was there. Anyway, the second breed is the English with eight. And as I said, there the blue ticks come next with half that many. Only four blue dogs, three males, one female. And surprisingly enough, there's three crossbred dogs, two males and a female. And then your black dogs that you guessed to be second, shame on you. there's only two. There's a male and a female. And two, where the red fern grows, red bones, and they're both males. They're chauvinists. They wouldn't let the little females play. So, and I guess you know what that leaves, but we're used to it.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the podcast? I don't think you were with me then. Or at least on that podcast when I talked about we did a tribute to my friend Bill Wickham. And he went out to Pine Bluff, Arkansas to the ACHA World Hunt with a dog he had called Bear. And he said, when they made the opening announcement, they talked about 500 and some entries in the World Hunt, and they listed them all. And of course, the walkers were the most, and they came down the list: English, blue tick, black and tan, red bone. And to quote Bill, and you know, this is exactly what the announcer said, and one damn plot. That was it. So we're used to that position, but doggone, fellas, we didn't even get one in this year. So,
oh boy. But, well, there's always next year. You got to remember that.
Oh yeah. Well, that's hope springs eternal, doesn't it? Well, you know, this tournament champions deal is pretty cool. You go out there and you go to a region and you win. Hopefully, they do a top. Well, to qualify, there's a prorated number based on the overall total, and the percentage of entries you got from that region determines how many you get to advance to the finals, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, you know, the way they do it there, it's two nights. It's kind of like a zone hunt for the World Hunt. And they take double cast winners first, and then single high scoring cast winners to build up to whatever that magic number is based on the overall entries from that zone or region, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, I'm doing good here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there were 96 dogs, so that made 24 casts, putting that public school math to work again here. So 24 casts will go to the woods on Thursday night. You know, I remember going out and being part of the media team on that first tournament of champions, the year that our good friend Bill from over in Ohio with Bad Butch won it. And, you know, that was a real honor for me to be able to do that. And I appreciated that so much and got to sit behind the sport desk and comment on the cards and the rules and all that. So it was a real honor, and I appreciate that UKC allowing me to do that. But that was a lot of fun, you know, and they really do it up well. Have you been to a tournament of champions, Corey?
Not yet. No, I haven't been to one myself, but
yeah, well, they've got this wedding venue, which is, I don't know where the popularity came to get married in a barn. Did you get married in a barn?
No.
My mother always used to say when we walked in the house without closing the door, she said, "Were you born in a barn? Close that door." But no, that's a big thing. You know, they develop these barns or timber framed buildings that are high ceilings and all rustic, beautiful. Well, I don't know how UKC found this place out there in the woods in Greencastle, but man, what a nice venue it is. I mean, it is first class. And they come in there, man, and they break out the groceries. On Thursday night, they feed everybody, and they do interviews with everybody, and they take everyone's picture, and they, you know, they just make a great big production out of it, and they film it all, and it's live streamed, and man, it's a big deal.
I think that's the one cool thing that's come out of the Tournament of Champions is the media coverage. I mean, we've never had an event covered like the Tournament of Champions is covered.
By far, it has set the bar. And, you know, I applaud Josh Michaelis, what he's doing with this Canestream Media and that stuff, and Greg and Scott and their partner. I can't always remember the other fella in pro sport. But anyway, and they're doing a really good job, but this thing is just head and shoulders above anything when it comes to the production, the layout, the food, the attention to detail. They have Eukanuba's, their big sponsor, that is there, and you got the huge blow up dog out front when you come in, and banners everywhere, all tastefully done. It's first class in every way. And if you're a coon hunter and you walk up that walk toward the building, it's called Three Fat Labs. Like the lab. I don't know where that came from. I'm not going there. I don't know. But anyway, it makes you proud to be there. I promise you that. But so anyway, they go out there and they put those 96 dogs in 24 casts, and they hunt. What do they hunt? 90 minutes? Or do you know?
I believe 2 hours.
2 hours? Okay.
Yeah.
So then they got 6 cast winners that will come back on Friday night. So those are actually, they have 24 cast winners that come back to hunt on Friday night in 6 casts, 6 four-dog casts. So, and that's a 2-hour. Yeah, I have your notes, earlier notes, Corey. It's 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we've milked it down to 6 dogs. But they don't, you know, they want a 3-dog final. So they run those 6 dogs in a head-to-head round, a 90-minute cast. 3 2-dog casts early on Saturday night. And then late, the 3 that are left standing hunt for the tournament champions. And that's not too shabby, the check that they get for first place.
Yeah.
50 grand.
My God.
50 grand. That's more than I paid for my first house.
Yeah.
Or my first truck. Possibly close to my house and my truck.
Well, you know, a couple noteworthy things about the regions too is when these dogs are competing for this kind of substantial prize, you know, that the Tournament of Champions offers, there's actually a couple of rules that differ from other typical UKC events. And one of those is what the requirements are to advance In certain circumstances, the dog doesn't need to have a total score of plus points to advance. So I think the requirements are that the dog has to have made a legitimate tree at some point during the cast, whether that have been a tree with a raccoon in it or what we call a circle tree, or a tree where you couldn't verify the raccoon was actually there, but it might have been. So dogs can advance without plus points in this particular event. And also, the handlers of these dogs have the option whether they want to hunt one night or two, which I thought that was total news to me. I didn't realize that was something that they were able to do.
Now, this is at the regions level, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed, the other thing that I learned that I didn't know about Tournament of Champions is there's only one scratchable offense when you get to the region, the Tournament of Champions, and that is being scratched for fighting. That will eliminate competition. But that is the only requirement based on what I've read.
So they want to let the dogs play. They want to let the dogs compete.
Absolutely. And,
you know, back in the day, and this might be picking at a scab, you know, that was kind of the basic difference in the philosophy of UKC and PKC, or at least we heard this from the hunters a lot, was in UKC, the rules were kind of designed to eliminate dogs. You know, scratch for this, scratch for that, time limitations, throw the card out if the time wasn't down to the minute figured on the front of the scorecard and all these kind of things. And PKC's philosophy was more of let them compete, you know. Just there was no maximum or minimum number of minus points that you could receive to be scratched, things like that, you know. So those were some kind of fundamental differences in the registries back in the day. But that's, you know, the more these rules, more organizations and all, the more the rules are beginning to look alike now. And that's something the hunters have asked for years. You know, they've wanted a uniform set of rules. And I think the registry's a little bit of pride, saying, well, no, we like our rules because they're our rules. And, you know, so.
Well, and I actually got to see that play out this weekend. I took my little plot female that I'm hunting to her first competition hunt on Monday night.
Oh, yeah.
Being that I was hunting on a Monday night, you should know what registry I was hunting in. I was hunting a PKC hunt, and we actually saw that play out, you know, in that particular cast. I drew a three-dog cast, and my dog went in and treed, and unfortunately she left the tree, and she ended up eating some minus on strike as well. But then she went in and treed a coon and by herself, and we had the other two dogs had split treed at that point, and the dog that ended up winning that cast was one of the other dogs that hadn't incurred any minus, but we didn't score a coon in his tree. He had a total score of zero with some circle points. So
did you have plus points?
I did, but I had more minus points than I had plus points. Okay.
Your final score was in the minus. I got you.
Correct.
Well, there's little differences there, but at any rate, so next weekend then, folks, from when you're listening to this, and we do appreciate you so much. I just got the ability back to view all the stats on these podcasts and see how well they're doing and all, and it's gratifying to know that as many of you out there as there are that listen to us each week, and we really appreciate you for that. So Tournament Champions, that's going to be big news. People be glued to their YouTube, to their devices as this whole media extravaganza plays out there in Putnam County. Indiana, out there in the corn country.
I know. Make a point of staying up and watching the media coverage myself all night while it's going on. It's nice. It's really nice for a guy like me that hasn't had the ability to travel around and accrue cast wins to compete in this kind of event. It's very gratifying to be able to sit back and feel like I'm part of the action. So yeah, I definitely appreciate that.
Well, we've come so far in this sport from the days, really, when the magazines were our only connection to what was going on out there in the world of coon hunting, unless we had close, you know, we had personal friends that we could communicate with. Long distance phone calls cost extra back in those days. And speaking of media, I saw a post just today by Danny Duby, the editor of Full Cry Magazine, saying that the new issue has mailed.
Has it? Really?
Yeah, and this is a mustard-colored cover. And it's got a picture. I believe, did you not see that on social media, the picture of the dogs baying a lion up on that outcropping of rock?
Well, now that you mention it, I think I did see something about that. I usually get my copy a couple days later than what everybody else does for some reason, but yeah, I think I did see
that. Well, I haven't seen my copy yet either because I'm in Florida and we get it late. And we used to, being in the publishing business at UKC, we used to get the people would complain and someone would say, I know my mail carrier's reading my magazine. So when he gets through with it, that's when I get it. But yeah, Full Cry, man, it's really a great read each, every other month. You get six issues, and wow, it's just a great, great read. And I realize that most people get their reading material online nowadays. We know that's true. But there's a lot of people that still enjoy holding a nice publication in their hand. Isn't this one's all color, it's on a nice grade paper, the pictures all stand out. It's just a great job, and kudos to Danny and to her husband Jason there, and they're just doing a good job. And if you're not, man, I gotta wonder if you're not taking Full Cry out there and you call yourself a coon hunter nowadays or a houndsman. I mean, what's going on? You know,
I mean, well, it's one of those deals that you're perfectly content until you actually read it or subscribe to it. And then there's no way that you'd be able to be content with just your alternative options. You know?
Right. Right. And there'll come a time, guys, for no other reason, just built for posterity. You know, there will come a time when those old cranky knees won't let you get out there and follow those hounds like you do now. And you'll enjoy being able to reach over there and pick up one of those volumes and go back and read those stories. Got some good writers stepping forward, you know, and It's a wide array of subject matter, and any houndsman would really enjoy it. Well, we're not getting paid to advertise Full Cry, but I do feel like on this podcast we need to give our listeners as much good information as we can about our sport, the positive things about the sport, and that definitely is a positive. All right, Corey, we talked earlier. We've almost talked up an hour here, but we talked earlier about maybe going over to some of the things that have been posted lately to the Coon Hunting Conversations group page on Facebook. Do you visit that fairly regularly?
Oh, yeah. We got a few questions queued up from our listeners and people who participate with the Facebook page. So we appreciate you guys contributing to that Facebook page and giving us stuff to talk about. But, how do you want to do this? Do you want me to go first and pick one?
What we're going to do here, friends and neighbors, is just kind of pick out a few of the threads that have been on there recently that's, you know, kind of sparked some interesting questions, and some of them you'll find humorous, no doubt. But, jump on in there with both feet, Corey.
Okay. Well, the first one we're going to talk about a little bit comes from Daniel Phillips. It was posted about 5 days ago. And Daniel's question is being a loner a natural thing, or can it be taught? And if so, how? So in that particular question, he's talking about the dog's natural tendency to want to hunt by itself rather than hunting with other dogs. So how about you take the helm first, Steve?
Okay.
Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, we talk about this a lot, about is it genetic or is it man-made? And I have to be from the camp that most of it is man-made, especially for the guys that are really in the heat of the competition world today. Somehow, sometime, it got to be popular to get a dog that would get away from the crowd, get away from everything else, and, get out there and tri-a-coon on his own. I guess the original thinking was before another dog could, you know, even cover it, during the time limits. Those limits have been shortened considerably. It used to be 5 minutes from the time a dog was treed. The other dogs were able to get in and get some of the 3 points, a lesser amount. Sometimes I tend to get, I think, too elementary in my descriptions and my answers. But the only reason I do that is to try to think about that guy that may be brand new to the sport and just doesn't really understand the way the rules work. But yeah, and you know, this is not anything real new. I remember when I was in Michigan going hunting with various guys, and they would try to set their dogs up to fail. They would get a dog treed and they would slip in to the tree and have their dog released by someone else back at the truck or whatever. And if that dog came into that tree, they took charge of that tree and ran that dog off. Yeah. And let him know that. Yeah. Mm. And that's predominantly the way that it was done originally. And then, of course, with the track and train features of the collars that we have nowadays, you know, you can watch that dog and you can see if that dog's advancing toward another dog that's either struck a track or is already treed. And you can dissuade that dog from going that direction with that electronic device. And I think that's how most of these dogs are made to be, just stone loners, you know, dead loners, they call them.
Well, I think that there's a big difference when we're standing in the camp of natural tendencies and genetics and all that kind of stuff. I think there's a big difference between a competitive dog that is able to get split treed and a dog that is naturally independent. Because I don't want to sound like I'm pumping my own tires here, but you know, in my time in this sport, I can honestly say that I've had well over 60, 65 dogs here, different dogs at different times, at different age levels, different breeds, all kinds of stuff. And I can probably count on my one hand how many of those dogs I had that if you turn them loose to a dog that was treed, that would just go right around them and tree by themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most of the time when we're in a competitive environment, dogs are just, these coonhounds are just naturally independent, or not independent, but competitive. Most of them are, especially when you get into the competition level. And a lot of them are looking to get split, but I think there is a difference between natural independence and just being competitive, for sure.
Yeah, I certainly have had dogs that were naturally independent. Mm-hmm. That tend to be by themselves a large percentage of the time. The dog we talked about last week was that way. If there was any way he could be split-treed from the other dogs, that's where he would be. And I know that those dogs, you know, they were kennel mates and so forth, and they weren't running him away. He was just preferred to be, you know, on his own. I think you bring up the word competition, and that does definitely exist in the soul of some hounds. You can see it in such fundamental ways as when you first cut the dogs, that racehorsing toward the woods. You know, that one dog, he's going to bust himself to be the first one to the woods, you know, to find something to tree. And my mind is going here in all directions, as it usually does. But you also see those dogs we talk about that at some point in their careers, they get hunt sour. And they don't want to compete anymore because they're sulking because they've gotten beat. They've gotten, you know, they're used to going out, being the boss dog, treeing the coons, being the first. And then here comes a little dog along that's treeing a coon here and there ahead of them, and they sulk, and they pout. And, you know, some of them just quit to the extreme, go back to the truck. But at any rate, they just get out there and just kind of hang around somewhere and don't, you know, I didn't do it. I wasn't first, therefore I'm not going to participate. But okay, let's take this in this way. This always comes to mind to me when this conversation comes up. We look at a cattle dog, like we had a blue heeler here, and the natural instinct to herd. You know, Cody, he wanted his people all in the same room. If I was in one part of the house and Ella was in the other, he wanted to go get the one that was out there and bring it to the other. He wanted, you know, everything to be, have his ducks in a row, so to speak.
Sure.
Okay. Was that just natural in some dogs? And somebody said, oh, I saw that in that dog, so that's what I want, so I'm going to breed for that. No, somewhere that was taught. My point is, without citing a lot of examples, labs with waterfowl, any tree dogs, whatever. At what point does the habit, the behavior become genetic, makes that turn around the corner to daddy was this way? Dad, you know, we often say, well, if you've got a man-made independent dog, you got to remember that he's not going to pass that down genetically. His offspring are going to have to be man-made just like he was. But there is a point where all that training seems to filter into the genetics. You ever thought about that?
No, but that's an interesting point you make, for sure.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Because if you think of all these dogs that are used for all these different things, how did they begin to pass those traits down? Either they were natural from the very start, and somebody was lucky enough to find one that would herd sheep, and this other guy had one on the next farm, and we bred the two. And so, I can see how that happens. But some of these traits, you know, and I think I'm just going to go ahead and say it, and you can say, Fielder, you're old, you're softy, I'm appalled by guys that use harsh corporal training methods to make independent dogs.
Yeah.
If he's not naturally that way, I really don't want him. Yeah. Now they're saying, well, Fielder, we haven't seen you in the payout line lately. So, you know, we're just going to continue to do our thing, you know, and
just like anything else, Steve, it's a good trait to have, but you can't breed it to the extreme. And I oftentimes worry about that, you know, in regards to other things that are going on in our culture as far as land access and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of wonder if and when we may head the opposite direction as breeders and as you know, participants of these competitive events. So,
well, no doubt we will, Corey. I believe we will. It will be mandated to us. We will have no choice.
Yeah, you're more than. But well, let's try to get another one.
All right.
I think we've covered that one pretty thoroughly. But I know you had an interesting one, Stephen. I'm interested to.
Well, there was one that I thought was a little humorous. Well, there's a couple. This first one, though, if I can find him, just a second. This comes from Tom Johnson. Why aren't stud dogs moved around to different parts of the country for an opportunity to have more pups out of different gyps? Okay.
All right. So who's going to take that one first?
Well, you're certainly welcome to it if you want to take a bite.
Well, you know, I've been fortunate enough to play the stud dog game a time or two with a couple of different males I've had. You know, hypothetically speaking, I can say that they are, and maybe not in the physical sense, but you know, the beautiful art of artificial insemination and artificial breeding puts these stud dogs on another level that we could have only dreamed about 15 to 20 years ago, and even further back than that. But you know, there are a lot of your major stud dogs are going to be collected. Their semen is going to be collected and either frozen or collected in some way to use in the future or in different locations than what the dog is actually physically in. So I guess the way that I would answer that is I think that we're doing a pretty good job of spreading the genetics around without actually moving the dog himself.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that come to mind here, and there's several answers. Let's see. This Rocky Tanner answers, they ship semen all over the country, and it's getting easier to find vets that are successful at AI, is my guess, for a good main reason. And that's a good answer, Rocky. And Corey, you've already, covered that there. Yeah. And then here, Cliff Owen makes a good point here too. That was probably one of the first things that I thought about is if I've got a dog that I'm proud of, I'm not going to just send him over to somebody over in St. Louis just because I want to get him bred a lot. You know, Cliff says mostly because the owners are scared to let someone else have possession of the dog. A lot of things can happen, and AI is gaining in popularity. So that's a good answer. And and I think that's probably one.
I will say Milton Baker brings up a good point. He says, I wouldn't trust my dog with nobody. You know, Milton, depending on the dog we're talking about, I'd probably be in the same boat as you. Yeah. So.
Well, Michael Brown here. Mike, I don't want to call you out, but I'm going to have to delete your comment because of the language. But you say it costs more money than it's worth, and most folks in stud business don't feel like dealing with tire kickers. And, you know, that's a point to be made. If you're running a stud dog, I've talked to guys like Mac McAllister out in Springfield, Missouri, who had Lipper, you know, when he died. Actually, he was at Joiners out in, I believe, in Kentucky when he actually died and was was actually put in a freezer. And Mac told him, said, go ahead and bury the dog, you know. And that's probably a Lipper story that some people hadn't heard before. But Mac, you know, told me, you know, I mean, the endless stream of phone calls. This was in the days before emails, text messages. The only way you had to contact somebody was through a written letter or a phone call. And the phone calls would come at all hours of the night. You know, you got a coon hunter out there in a different time zone that's been out hunting that night, and he gets back home and he discovers that his dog is coming in heat, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and he said, oh man, she's coming in heat. I better call old Mac and book his female, you know. Get her a slot, you know. So the phone rings at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, that's an extreme example, but believe me, that's happened many, many times. So it is a pain. And somebody says, well, I'll exchange that pain for the money. And you got to be that kind of guy to say, yeah, you know, this money is really important to me. And I'll put up with, you know, all of this aggravation. Probably one of the biggest things is guys call and say, I'll be there Saturday at 2 o'clock and don't show up. The guys postponed a family day, you know, maybe a picnic or a ball game or something to be there to accommodate the guy. And the guy just doesn't show up. Coon hunters, I don't care. You know, at times, especially when I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, because I worked late a lot, I'd have a date to go coon hunting with the guys, and I'd have to call them and say, look, I'm running late. I'm not going to be there at 6:30 as we originally planned. If you guys want to go ahead. I'll find you. Tell me where you're going. I'll catch up with you or whatever. Make that phone call. Don't have guys sitting out there waiting on you, not knowing whether you're going to be there or not. And at the worst extreme, just fail to show up. You know, let your word be worth something, you know. So those are just little coon hunting etiquette things that I'm passing along at no charge. And this would be the point where you'll probably want to hit the little sliding rule down there at the bottom and slide on toward the end. But anyway, running a stud dog is not all it's cracked up to be. And if the pups turn out great, well, yeah, that's good. But if they're not, guess who's going to get the blame? Even though they may not have had a fair chance. You know, so you're putting yourself out there to run a stud dog, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Is there any more comments in that thread that we should...
I think we covered it pretty well.
One guy jumps in and said, I'd like to find a good English male close to such and such a town in Virginia to breed one. Well, you know, you get all kinds of comments. But and then Mark Miller, as we had on the podcast last week, he says, why don't more females travel to the stud dogs? Well, that's what every stud owner wants. But it doesn't always work out that way. Well, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. A wise man told me one time, he was a Redbone man, and his name was Kelly Hyde. And he said, if you own a good female, you own every stud dog in the country. And he was right about that.
That's exactly right. I've said that for many, many years. You know, you get a good female, the world is your oyster. You can, if you've got the greenbacks, you can go breed to any stud dog in the country. And but on the other hand, you got a nice stud dog there. It's hard to find the good females to breed to, and you can't vet them all. You know. You want to. In years past, I've seen guys saying at stud to Grand Night champion females only, or things like that, you know. All right. Well, there you go. If you aspire to be a stud dog owner, maybe that helped you a little bit. You want to take the one about the heads on the dogs, Corey?
That one made me laugh a little bit. I'm not trying to be ignorant, but Jacob Perkins brings us the question of the day. What trait is putting the smaller heads on dogs these days instead of the traditional big blocky head?
Well,
who wants to start with that?
Well, I don't know. Someone said, there's all kinds of funny answers on this one. And one that popped right up at the top was fluoride in the water. I don't know what fluoride has to do. Well, I guess, you know, we have fluoride in our toothpaste. Wonder why we don't have a lot more tiny-headed people. I don't know. I don't much think it's fluoride. Someone said it's probably inbreeding. Now, that's taking a stab. And, that's a whole can of worms right there, but we can open it. Close family breeding, or what we call inbreeding, breeding to close relatives, doesn't necessarily cause problems. But it does bring the problems within that line to the surface more quickly so that they can be eliminated. And that was the aim of the breeders in breeding family breeding their dogs. You have any experience with that, Corey?
Well, a little bit here and there, but one thing that I might add to the discussion is there are certain trends that tend to pop up from time to time and generation to generation. And I'm not talking about the dogs per se. I'm talking about the people breeding the dogs more or less. And trends, they get popular, and certain breeders aim to please as far as these trends go. And big blocky heads were definitely a trend at one point in time or another. And now, you know, there are a lot of trends out there that say, well, we don't need to breed the best looking dog. We just need to breed a performer, right? We need to breed the best hunting dog that we can. And some people get to those trends at different times, and ultimately it does affect our gene pool if it's a large enough trend. So that might be part of the equation there. I mean, just from my two cents, but, I think it's really hard to ascertain one particular aspect or one particular genetic trait that's causing it.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. And, there's just things that seem to go together, like apple pie and ice cream, you know. The smaller-headed dog, the finer muzzle and all, tend, and not always, there's exceptions to every rule, but they tend to produce a higher pitch mouth, a squealy mouth. We think of foxhounds. And you listen to a pack of foxhounds running, you're going to hear a lot of mouths that will somewhat resemble a pack of coyotes, you know. and that sort of thing. And traditionally, the bigger chuckle-headed dogs had the bigger mouths, the blue ticks, the black and tans. You know, of course, I've seen some of these walker dogs down through the years, as we'd say, their head wouldn't fit in a 5-gallon bucket, you know. Big-headed dogs. And that generally, you know, the bigger mouth, the deeper voice, the bigger head, the longer ears. The old hunters used to say, this dog's got a flat tree head. You can lay a rubber ball on the top of his head and it won't roll off.
That sounds like a valuable treat to have.
There you go. And that went along with the tree knot. That was that, what is that called? Precipital bone or whatever, right at the top of the dog's skull there. Students of canine anatomy will crucify me for mispronouncing that. But anyway, and then having black on their tongue, a black spot on their tongue was a trait of a tree dog, and all these kind of things.
You know, a good one I heard one time was, so I don't know what the technical term is for it, but most every dog has a bump right underneath their lower jaw, okay? And okay. I heard an old hunter tell me one time, he said, there's little chin hairs that grow out of that bump. And like I said, I don't know the technical term for that bump.
Mm-hmm.
But an old hunter told me one time, he said, count those chin hairs. If he's got three, he'll treat.
If you got three, you'll treat. Okay, guys, I want you when this podcast is over or when you – go back to the kennel. I want you to count those little bump hairs, as Corey calls them. I know there's got to be a name for those. I just call them their whiskers. But anyway, if you got three, it will tree.
I think it goes, if he has three, he'll tree, and if he has four, you'll be sore.
There you go. Well, Gordy Dernick up there in Pennsylvania, one of your neighbors, said, what trait? LOL, the small head trait. As if, you know, there is a small head trait going around in our coonhound world. I don't really think so. If you pick up, you know, your phone and look at the results, PKC started that habit of lining the four dogs in the final four up facing the camera, with the handlers kneeling beside them. When I came along, I had a pet peeve, and it was interesting to see that my successor, Jerry Maul, carried on that thing. I had a pet peeve when you're looking at those nice dogs, looking at them. I used to tell the guys, I said, just straighten their front ends up, okay? Get their legs square in the front. The rest of it is not even going to show in the picture. Just get those front ends straight and get them looking at the camera. And for God's sakes, take those leads off their collars. They're dangling there. We're not trying to do a dog supply store to see how many different kinds of leads we got here. Just take the leads off and lay them behind the dog. Oh, man, I took a ton of pictures over the years of winning dogs, especially when I was with PKC and AKC. And I would say, all right, boys, you know the drill. Take those leads off and hide them behind you. And, I'd get the looks, man, the eye rolls, all that stuff. But I want to look at that dog, you know. And as I look at those dogs, those photos nowadays, I don't see any preponderance of sharp muzzles. We used to say a dog could eat peanuts out of a pop bottle. You know, his muzzle was so slim. Do you see that much?
I can't say that I do. And I do. I have the good fortune to judge a lot of bench shows too. And you know, honestly, and the amount of shows that I've judged, you know, from last year until now, I can't even say that I see that too often. So.
Right. Well, it's been a fun topic. Jim Frederick out in Illinois says it's all the rat terrier crosses that we're making. Jason Jones says it's fox dogs, and I kind of already touched on that. And then here's something about breeding, and we'll drop a few names. This Brian Atkins says the dog named Four Times Floyd is putting the size and mouth on his pups. And he shows a pup here, a big chuckle-headed pup, and he said, the pup is full of Old Sackett Jr. and Nocturnal Nailer on his damn side. And so anyway, yeah, you know, it's genetic, those big-headed dogs. The cruise dog that I talked about on podcasts for a long, he was a big-headed dog. In fact, I didn't think the rest of his body was going to catch up with his head when he was a pup. But anyway, well, that's two or three people say genetics, you know, and Jerry Michaels, we'll close with you. He said, I'd say it's inbreeding and lots of line breeding. Well, anyway, I can't pass this one, and this kind of goes along with it, but he says form follows function. This is Terry Parker. The more you breed for speed, the more you will see speed dog traits, which, again, we're talking back toward the fox dogs, you know, and the running dogs. So maybe some of that.
So what they're saying is we're making them aerodynamic.
I guess so. I guess so. And then Michael E. Shepherd has the best one of all, and we'll finish on that one. Breeding dogs without a lot of brains. That's why. You got a small head, you just can't pack a lot of brains in that spot. Which now that's going to provoke the ire of all our listeners that know that it's not the size of the, I guess a small-brained dog can have just as many smarts as a big-brained dog. I know. I think about the little border collies and Shelties and obedience trials. Man, those things are scary smart, and they don't have a lot of headroom in there for the gray matter. So, anyway, Corey, that's kind of going to shine the tree, as we say, for the coon hunting conversations. Discussion tonight, and we've been at this almost 1.5 hours, so I think it's enough to torment these listeners, don't you?
I think so.
Well, I apologize for people today being on this trip. I'm using a new setup here. I'm using my headphones with the microphone attached the way I do out at the events and all, and I don't know how many times I've hit that microphone stem in this podcast tonight, so I know that's translating probably into your truck radio or wherever you're listening. But, man, we do appreciate you so much. I do want to tell you that I have got a new supply of the Zep Lifetime Coon Squallers coming. They're on the way, and that's the reason why I suspended the weekly spins for the last few weeks, but we're going to be starting those back up right away. As soon as I get back home from this trip, we'll be doing the weekly spins where we'll take a question of the week from the current podcast and post it on Facebook. And if you answer it correctly, your name will go on the wheel and you'll get to spin for the squaller, a $30 value lifetime Zep Coon Squaller, 3 reeds with a lanyard, and you'll also get your own personalized copy of Gone to the Dogs, A Coon Hunter's Journey. So anyway, that's going to resume right away. Anything to add, Corey Groover?
No, I'm looking forward to seeing the results from Tournament of Champions. So if anybody wants to have a watching party with me, kind of like a Super Bowl style party, and then let's do it.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I posted a thread or a post a while back, and I said, how cool would it be during that Joy Super Hunt to have a watch party at the tennis center in Flora and have all the old gang there for a watch party watching the YouTube on a giant screen up front? Well, right away, all the replies were, oh, I'd love to go back to Flora for the hunt. I wish we'd take the world hunt back there, yada, yada. That wasn't my intent. My intent was to try to see if we could spark the idea of a watch party, a coon hunter's watch party. You know, I think that would be a total hoot to have a room full of coon hunters watching at the same time, you know. Oh, well.
I think you're on the phone, Steve.
Well, maybe we can get that promoted somehow. Well, Corey, it's good to talk to you again. It's great having you aboard here, and you've made my job so much easier by I'm stretching these old worn out brain cells to the max here week after week, and you sure helped me lighten that load. And I appreciate you so much, and I appreciate these listeners that are coming. Onto the podcast every week and listening and commenting. Send me a comment on Facebook or send to Corey Groover, Gruver. Let us know how we're doing here. Anything special you'd like us to talk about, we'll tackle it. We'll talk about anything, as you know.
Just about.
Corey?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought I lost you. Well, I tell you what, guys, watch the UKC coverage of the Tournament of Champions, their biggest hunt of the year. See who's going to take home that big Happy Gilmore check for $50,000. That's, I don't think there's anybody that could argue with that. Now, I got to run out here right quick and buy a lottery ticket. I don't play the lottery. But it's like over $1 billion now, I think, in New Jersey.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, it's like crazy over here. So I'm like, well, nah, I'll wait till it gets into some serious numbers. That's always tickled me when people say, hey, it's only $1 million. I'm not going
to. Exactly.
Okay, Corey, the best to you, and I hope everything goes well in the maternity department. You're going to be announcing the birth of a new daughter in May, and we're all looking forward to that big time. And so, listeners, if you need anything in the way of hunting supplies for you or your dogs, there's one place to go that I know you're going to be satisfied, and that's W Hunting Supply, DUSupply.com. Folks, if they ask where is the Pennsylvanian and the transplanted hillbilly, just tell them they're out there trying to follow around a couple of plot dogs, as hopeless as it seems, and they are treeing a coon now and then. But mostly they've just gone to the dogs. Good night, Corey.
All right. Good night, Steve. Take care, everybody.